Tom Maddie has joined us on Sports Byline. When you think about the Colts and when you first got there, tell me what your first impressions were.
Well, this was a team that had won the 58-59 championship. This is 1961. These guys were probably a dynasty right at that time. And, you know, coming in here, I was scared to death, you know. And playing running back and not playing quarterback was a new job for me. I had to understand what was going on. And when you had guys like, you know, John Unitas, Raymond Berry, Gino Marchetti, Lenny Moore, you know, these guys were the all Hall of Fame guys, and I'm playing with Artie Donovan, my goodness, you know, the father time I used to call him. It was amazing. But you know, it was a great team. Weeb Eubank was a coach at that particular time. He stayed there for the first couple of years. And then Shula came along in 1963. And, you know, and then we started our march. But I only had one losing season the whole time I was in the ball with the Baltimore Colts organization, which was 12 years, and that was in 1972 when Bob Irsay became the owner and Carol Rosenblum took over the Los Angeles Rams. So it was a whole different team. That these guys were just, Bob Irsay was sort of a turkey, a drunk, and the whole wall of work wax. But his son Jimmy is really a great kid.
Was there any correlation between Woody Hayes and his coaching and Weeb Eubank? Because you know, I remember Weeb. I had him on the show before he passed away, and he had that flat top. And Joe has told me some great stories about him when he was playing for him as well.
Yeah, Weeb and Woody were good friends. But Weeb had a great offense. He was a good coach, a good offensive coach. Not too much on defense, but boy, he knew the offense very well. And even when Shula came on board with us, we never changed our offensive plans at all. Shula added some new defenses to our team. But, you know, Weeb was so well organized. But on game day, you might as well pack Weeb away. He was, he'd walk around the sideline and say, go tell John to call. Tell him to get a first down. You know, one of those kind of deals. So I'd run on the field and John would look at me and he'd say, the usual. And I says, yeah, get a first down. So it was sort of funny. But he was a great organized man. And our practices were very well organized. And we just had a lot of fun playing.
And certainly one of the great, or actually two of the great storytellers of sports, in my opinion, Artie Donovan and Gino Marchetti.
Artie Donovan is a classic all by himself. And, you know, I had read up on Artie Donovan and before I got to training camp. And his father was a referee for the Joe Louis fights. So I had read about that. And I come into training camp because I was at the college all-star game. And I come in, there's a big crowd of people, and I asked the guy who picked me up, I said, who's that? And they said, oh, that's Mr. Donovan. So I run over to Mr. Donovan. I said, Mr. Donovan, it's so nice to meet you. I can't wait to meet your son. Well, he didn't think that was too funny because Artie, at that particular time, was at the end of his career. He looked older than my father. And, you know, so he really got PO'd at me because he said, shut up, kid. You know, he talks like that Brooklyn accent. And he was all over me. But he's the greatest storyteller. People still love him in Baltimore. He's had some tough times recently. And Jim Mutchler, who was a tight end for us in the 58-59 championship games, he's having a tough time right now, too. So it's but Artie's, I think, 88 right now. And he's still kicking, and he still holds court. He has a little country club that has weddings and that kind of stuff. And he has a little bar there, and he sits back in the corner and just sits there and tells stories.
What was it about Johnny Unitas that made him the great quarterback that he was? Because he was drafted in, like, what, the 16th, 17th, 18th round, I believe.
Yeah, he was. And then we picked him up from Pittsburgh, I guess.
Yeah.
Colts did. And John just was a cool cucumber. I mean, he always knew what he was trying to set something up. He always had a play planned or two or three plays planned in a row just to be able to take advantage. He was a brilliant football player, and he had a great touch on the football. And again, you know, you still have to have the horses up front, and our offensive line was pretty good at that particular time. And so John had the time to throw the ball, and when you got receivers like Raymond Berry and Lenny Moore and Jimmy Orr and John Mackey, I mean, you get the ball to them, they're going to make big plays out of it, and they did.
Let me take you back to that 65 season. Late in the season, of course, you take over at quarterback because Unitas and Quazzo both go down with season-ending injuries. When they called on you, did you just look at them?
Well, I thought they were kidding me. I said, you got to be kidding me. And he said, no, he says, you're the last man standing. We don't have any. Back in those days, we only had 40 on the roster to begin with. So you had to play multiple positions. I played second string running back. I was a third string fullback. I was a third tight end. I was the kicker or the punter. I was a punt return, kickoff return guy. I was also a defensive back. So and I could play outside receiver too. So I mean, I was playing everything, and that's why I guess Sable thought I was one of the most versatile players because I played everything. I had to, but John. John helped me so much with understanding the game and what you're trying to do when you're running the play, what you're trying to clear areas out and open it up for that receiver to come underneath or whatever. But it took a lot more mental capability in the pros than it ever did in college.
And of course, you had you lost those last two games against the Bears and the Packers. But you make, in that regular season finale, you win 2017 over the Los Angeles Rams and have to take on the Packers again, and you get robbed of the victory there. Tell everybody what happened in that game.
Well, we beat the Rams, and that's when they had the fearsome foursome. We beat them 2017, and one of the funny plays was we had stopped them at the goal line, and back in those days, the goalposts were right on the end, on the goal line right there. And I'm all nervous, and I'm talking to the offense, what do you think we ought to call? There's a timeout and all this kind of stuff. And my offensive line's heads were sort of bobbing back and forth. And do you remember Linda Morganson or whatever her name is, the sort of a goofy gal who, and she's up there and she's about half naked and their heads are going back and forth. And I'm saying, hey, guys, what do you think I ought to call? So I call 36 Trap, and Lynx comes up and taps me on the shoulder. He says, I'll run into the goalpost. I said, oh, my God. And Woody, Shula didn't let me have any automatics. So I got up the line of scrimmage, and I just said, automatic quarterback sneak on one. And my whole offensive line in the movies, their heads come up like this. I said, yep, quarterback sneak on one. I get 6 yards on the play, and Deacon Jones, we're running up the tunnel because there was only 6 seconds left on the clock. And we run up the tunnel. He comes up to me. He says, Matty? He says, call that play again, I'll knock your head off. He says, right, don't worry about it, I ain't going to call it. But that was a great one. Then we go up to Green Bay, and it was freezing cold, Christmas Day, and we're playing Green Bay, and Don Chandler kicks a field goal to tie the game towards the end of the game. The field goal was wide by 3 feet. The following year, that's one of the rules that changed in the NFL. The following year, they raised the goalpost 20 feet higher and put an official under each goalpost and one behind the kicker because they blew the call. And I got a letter from Jim Tunney the other day because he saw what we're doing with this keeper card that we have, and he says, will you please forgive me for blowing that call? And I says, I emailed him back, and I says, listen, that's so long over gone and everything, but I said, if you'll let me win that game, I may have made it into the Hall of Fame. not only my wristband, but maybe me.
Yeah, I was just going to say, your wristband, and explain to everybody, Don Shula helped you out by putting the plays on a wristband, right?
Yeah, I sure did. He and Don McCafferty both, the two of them, said, hey, listen, let's make it as simple as possible. And so I put them all down, and actually my wife printed smaller than I did. So I had all these plays, and now if you take a look at all the players that are using them at teams and colleges, everybody has a wristband on. They flip up the lid and take a look to see what play that is coming in from the sideline. I wish I'd have patented it. I could have made some money on the deal.
You played in a couple of Super Bowls, and, of course, we'll talk about Super Bowl III first. I want to get your thoughts about that because Joe Namath has shared with me what it was like from the other side with the Jets. But what was that Super Bowl like for you guys?
It was, all the hype was that we're going to kick their butts and all this kind of stuff. We were 17-point favorites and all that. I can say one thing. We had a lot of respect for Joe Namath and the Jets because Weeb was a coach here. And I thought he did an excellent job of coaching. He took advantage of some weaknesses that we had. Defensively, we had a couple guys hurt on the right, on the left-hand side of the line, and they ran that side. Matt Snell should have been, in my estimation, should have been the MVP. He had 120-some yards rushing. Joe didn't do that much, but of course, he was Hollywood Joe and put the finger up at number one and all that kind of stuff. So we were very, very disappointed and very let. Unitas didn't play in that game primarily because we were playing, John and I were playing racquetball together and he tore his Achilles tendon. But Earl Morrill came in and did a great job for us and was MVP of the league that year for bringing our team all the way up to the Super Bowl. But on that given day, Earl didn't have a very good game. Shula and John didn't get along too well. And I thought, if I were a coach, I'd probably put John, started Unitas in the second half because he was ready to come back. And I think we might have been maybe pull it out. Who knows?
What was it that you, Tom, you and the rest of the teammates heard about Joe Namath's prediction that they'd win that game? How did you hear the story? Did you hear it before the game? Because that's usually the type of stuff you put up on the bulletin board.
Yeah, you do. And Lou Michaels was out at some bar, and you know Namath was shooting his mouth off about how he's going to beat us and all this kind of stuff. And that's the one thing you usually do is you keep your mouth shut, because everybody can play that against you. Put it on the, just like you said, put it up on the bulletin board. Well, we were all PO'd about it, pretty much so. But you know, hey, stuff like that happens. And if it wouldn't have been for that game, I don't think the merger would have taken place either. So it was a big point.
Tom Maddy joining us on Sports Byline, the former NFL running back and part-time quarterback for the Baltimore Colts. He grew up in the Cleveland area where he played high school, went on to quarterback for Woody Hayes at Ohio State, and then, of course, drafted by the Baltimore Colts. He played 12 years his pro career, all with the Baltimore Colts. He went to 2 Super Bowls, number 3, in which they lost to the Jets, but he picked up a Super Bowl ring in Super Bowl number 5 in beating the Dallas Cowboys. We continue on Sports Byline.